Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Kiriko, joined by Tom.
Hello there.
And special guest, Bashabur.
Hi.
And hi, producer Elliot.
Hi.
To discuss why some female stereotypes in film need to be celebrated and why we need to love them. But more on that in a minute. I'm very happy to share that we have another Celebrating Cinema Film Club screening on October 23rd. We'll be screening Knight of Cups by Terrence Malick. You might be thinking that this has Hugo written all over this, but it instead turns out that there's someone else in this world who considers this an underappreciated masterpiece. Joining us for a special introduction is YouTuber and film video essayist Like Stories of Old. You can book your tickets via the link in the show notes. As always, if you love what we do here on Celebrating Cinema, you can support us by leaving a review on whichever podcast platform you listen on and share with your friends. It really helps more cinema lovers like yourselves to find us. Now, Basha, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm okay.
We are sitting in the space where 2 days ago you had your book release party.
Yes.
What did you make? What did you give to the world?
It's an essay, but it's one essay, but it's divided into five chapters. So it's actually five essays in a kind of small booklet. Not that small, but I intended it to be small, but there was a lot to say about it because it's about the way women look and how we show ourselves to the world. It's about costume history and art history, but also a lot of pop culture. So it was a lot to cover. So basically, I think it's about femininity and the way women look. It's called Liggend Naakt. It's in Dutch.
Love, love, love. Mm-hmm. And coinciding with the book release, you are also curating. Mm-hmm. A program here.
Well, I must say you curated most of it.
Okay. You helped, you helped.
You curated a program here at Lab.
Yeah, it's called Girls of Plenty and it's about performing femininity. And it has a lot of female main characters that are over the top, larger than life, and are really a pleasure to watch. Even though I was watching, of course, a lot of movies on the big screen and I thought, okay, there's a lot of nasty things also going on. I didn't realize. So there's lots of fun, but also like Cries and Whispers by Ingmar Bergman, which is really just a horror movie. But it's great. It's fantastic. And it looks incredible. And the performances are incredible. But it's also just a tough watch, actually.
Yeah. But it's also the inevitable, right? Like you sort of start this huge celebration of femininity and then with that always has to come all the horror.
Yeah,
of course. It only can exist alongside each other.
Yeah.
And I guess that through the years the representation of femininity changes extremely. Mm-hmm. And you see that in the program as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Maybe before we delve into the horrors and the celebration, I want to ask you guys what the latest film is that you watched, Basha.
Like I said, I saw a lot of Girls of Plenty, and the last one I watched was Lost Highway.
Nice.
Which is, I think, a minor Lynch, but still a Lynch. So still
a minor
very,
Lynch?
Very good.
As in, what is a minor Lynch?
I don't think it's his best movie, and it's not really typically Lynch in a way, but still it is. But it has some things in it, like the soundtrack is really not that Lynchy.
Mine Lynchy.
But we gave him Lynchian, but he now also has Lynchy.
Lynchy. Yeah. But it's still very interesting, very good. It's actually more about masculinity than femininity, but it has a great femme fatale take in it. And it's about a man killing his wife, but there's also a man in it that would kill his wife later on, which is kind of yuck. And it has Marilyn Manson in it. So, yeah.
So Lynchy.
Very Lynchy, yes.
How about you, Tom?
I saw a early preview of a film called A Different Man by Aaron Schimberg.
And how is that?
I was told to use three words. So I think the word bat and shit can be two words. So bat shit insane, I will say.
Hmm. In a good way.
I'm not allowed to elaborate on this, am I? No, it's Sebastian Stan, Bucky from what is it? Captain America. That actor, the guy who's Bucky's butt buddy or Captain America's best friend, whatever. That actor, who's now also playing Donald Trump in The Apprentice, which is coming up, is making weird career moves because now he's playing a guy with a, shall we say, deformed face and goes into a surgery to have his face, not restored, like to make him pretty, to make him Sebastian Stan. And then another guy comes in his life with a deformed face, played by the actor you also see in Under the Skin, the guy with that...
mask.
I don't
thing.
Know exactly what that condition is called, but then that guy becomes really famous, and he's like, "Wait, I had a deformed face before. Why?" And it's bizarre. It's really hard to describe what this film is about.
Sounds batshit crazy.
It's very batshit crazy. Oh, Kiriko, your turn.
Thank you for your interest. I recently saw, or the last film that I saw. Is a film, a Dutch film, that is going to be released, I think, during the Dutch Film Festival. It's called Triptych by Kevin Boitel, yeah. Which I would also describe as batshit crazy. super fun, one word.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for it and it looked... Well, it looked batshit insane.
Yeah. It's. I think it was not our last episode, but two episodes ago, we spoke about Dutch cinema, and I don't know. I think we praised it pretty well, or at least expressed our hope for Dutch cinema. And then I think this film is one big critique on what Dutch cinema is and what it has been, but in such a fun way that it is also a really great film.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Nice.
Basha, we asked you to prepare a cold open.
Yes.
Are you ready?
Yes. What is a stereotype? You could say that a stereotype is a broad gesture, a thick line drawing done with a felt tip pen instead of soft pencil strokes. A stereotype is a flat depiction of a person or a group of people, instead of a layered, nuanced portrait of a human being that contains, as they say, multitudes. But if a stereotype is a crude drawing, who is holding the felt tip pen? Who is drawing the lines? Stereotyping is about enlarging certain characteristics while ignoring others. A stereotype is about minimizing, keeping only one characteristic. But who decides which characteristic is being enlarged and which are being minimized? Think stereotypes and you think of damsels in distress, gold diggers and cougars, dumb blondes and ice queens, devoted wives and failing mothers, a princess, a mean girl, a woman scorned, a femme fatale, a crazy woman, a witch. In other words, think stereotypes and you think of women, because for some reason, most stereotypes are specifically female. Think female stereotypes and you think of negative stereotypes, because most of them are. These stereotypes portray women as hypersexual, overly ambitious, cold-hearted, greedy, vain, manipulative, mentally ill, mean. Think of female stereotypes and notice that all of them are related to a man. Think about it. Who thinks the femme fatale is dangerous? The man who is afraid of being seduced by her. Who looks at a woman and sees only sex? The man who wants to sleep with her. Who is scared of the woman scorned? The man who scorned her. Who is bothered by the childless cat lady? The man who fears her independence. You don't even have to be a heterosexual man to reduce a woman to her sexuality, her mental health issues, marital status, or work ethic. We have become used to looking at women through the eyes of a heterosexual man. We have become used to identifying with men instead of women, in books, movies, and art that have been made by men and defined by them. History is shaped by men. The images that surround us are rooted in their perspective. Is it even possible to change that or to go against it? What to do with female stereotypes? We can ignore them by portraying women more realistically, flaws and all, as human beings. We can create new stereotypes that negate the ones that already exist. But we can also own some of the existing stereotypes. We wouldn't reject them, but embrace them, exaggerate them, amplify them, make them bigger, better, raunchy, delicious, irresistible. You want a crazy bitch? Well, here she is. You want a dumb blonde, a cougar, a femme fatale? You think women are dangerous? Well, you're right. Manipulative, sure. Here's a dainty princess. Do you like her now? Here's a succubus from hell. What do you think of her? The trick to owning a stereotype is to find pleasure in them. So how do you tell the difference between a stereotype that is full of disapproval, suspicion, and hate, and a stereotype that's fun, pleasurable, and maybe a little subversive? Well, you can ask yourself a simple question. When you watch a character that is technically a stereotype, ask yourself this: do I enjoy watching her? It really is as simple as that.
Nice.
Yes.
Wow.
Impassioned.
Yes, I was afraid that you were not going to go to loving the stereotypes because you were, you know, burying them in the ground for so long, but you went there.
Yeah, because some of them are really nasty and some of them are just full of joy. And I'm really interested in the difference between that. And there are stereotypes that I love that other people hate, of course. So I'm also very interested in how you feel about them.
Well, what is your favorite, not character stereotype, but stereotype type? Like which one of the stereotypes that you just mentioned, for example, is like the one that you enjoy looking at most?
Yeah, that's really hard to say, but I think she has to be feisty in a way. And yeah, that's not really true. I also enjoy the victim, just like the really over exaggerated victim.
Yeah.
Especially if the woman is portraying herself as a victim, so she's owning that. So it really depends. It's really hard. It's really hard to say.
Depends on the mood.
Yeah, and on the whole character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, don't have an answer.
No, that's all right. How about you? Do you have a...
I really love the femme fatale. I was reading up on it this morning, and I think it's such a weird... Because as you say in your cold open, it's very much related to a lot of men's fears and desires being put into these Rita Hayworth characters or the Jean Tierneys or the Veronica Lakes or of these 1940s films. And everything is so easily relatable to... Okay, so this...
Can you just explain what a femme fatale is?
Yeah, I was about to.
Okay.
Thanks, Elliot. No, really good. Yeah, so the but probably Bashi can explain this way more better speak English than I am doing right now. Bashi, can you explain it? You've done your research on this.
Yeah, the femme fatale it's a film noir trope. You always have the fall guy, the sap in the film noir, and he's seduced by this woman that's really alluring and like a siren, you know. She's really like, come to me, singing, and
come to me, kill my husband.
Yeah, kill my husband, or I know an easy way to get money, or something like that. And he falls for it because he's stupid, and then she pays for it in the end for some reason. So she's really... It depends on the movie. In some movies, the femme fatale is really more like a human being, and in some movies, she's just plain evil, like in Leaver to Heaven.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that film. Yeah.
Jean Tierney. And she is great.
How to throw somebody from a stairs who's pregnant.
Yeah.
That movie is like batshit. Well, there you go.
Batshit crazy.
Really can't identify with her because she's really...
No. Yeah, she's psychotic.
Yeah, she's psychotic. But she kills herself to get revenge.
Spoiler!
I mean, oh, sorry. Oh, my God. It's still worth watching the movie.
Yeah, I saw it for the first time in Scorsese's, Journey Through American Cinema.
Yeah, A Personal Journey.
And the two most horrific scenes he shows in that documentary. And the first one is that she's kind of, can't remember it really well, but I think she's jealous of the kid of her husband or something.
Yeah, the little brother,
yeah,
I think.
So she steers a boat over his head. Yeah. Like the kid is swimming in a lake and she just, with these beautiful old Oliver Peoples glasses on, just slowly goes with the boat over his head.
Yeah.
Like, what? What is this?
It's also, most film noir are in black and white, and this one is in color. Yeah. And it's just, it looks so great. And she looks so great with the sunglasses and the blue sky. It's just fantastic. But as a character, I don't really enjoy her because it's too much. She's too evil.
Yeah.
And, well, the film itself hates her.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's a problem, I think. But you can have fun with the femme fatale. And
yeah, and I what I find interesting is that it's such a post-World War II thing that you see that during the war, a lot of women went into jobs that they didn't have before the war. So, they were literally in the military, I think, for the first time,
and
right?
And worked in factories.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
Because all the men were out to war.
Yeah, so women went from working in the kitchen to working real jobs. Well, that's not what that's what they thought. Oh God, I'm not gonna get out of that one. and there's it's such a weird reaction to emancipation. Like, oh no, hold on, they're making their own money now. They must be conniving. They are becoming independent. We must portray them as very evil people. Who also, because soldiers came back from the war. What had the women been doing all that time? They must have been sleeping with other men. Let's put that in that stereotype as well. Which makes the entire stereotype such a weird thing, because it's women very much being in control. Well, to an extent, like not like tyranny and lever to heaven, but very in control of their sexuality as well. But it's a wrong thing. It's like, let's still portray it as somebody who is evil, out for your money, here to destroy you. You, the man, the dumb sap, will be destroyed by this very emancipated woman in a way. But such a bizarre, it's almost like a paradox of sexism and emancipation at the same time.
Yeah, but that's the great thing about movies, I think, that you have the ending where most of the times it ends badly for the femme fatale. But you still also have the beginning where she is in control and she has all the power. So you can take that with you as well. You can forget the ending and you have the beginning. So it's still portrayed in this way. And after the war, you had in the 50s, this was a really boring era in Hollywood because you had all the, yeah, just the wives and the mothers. And it was really sappy because all the veterans that came back from the war needed to be comforted. So that stereotype was gone and all the strong women were gone from the screen. So I prefer, you know, the 40s and the beginning of the 50s with the femme fatale and the film noir. So in that way, the femme fatale really is very special and interesting. Yeah, so I agree with you.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, that was celebrating cinema.
Yeah. To the point where we agree with Tom, that's where the conversation always ends. Thank you so much for listening.
I will leave this podcast now.
Kiriko, what is your favorite stereotype?
I indeed think that it is a question that is difficult to answer with one answer. But I always have a very weak spot for the super whores.
Mm.
I don't know if that's the official term I would use for
Superman, super whore.
It sounds like a Marvel movie.
Yeah, it should be actually.
Super whores, Endgame.
Yeah. Yeah, like the Nomies in the film.
From Showgirls?
The Showgirl Nomi. And I think Hustlers is slowly becoming my Miami Vice, but
I love Hustlers.
Hustlers is like such a fabulous film.
Yes.
And I would say also like what happens to Nomi after Nomi is, I think, Hustlers in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the idea that a woman is an object of sex, and what if she is only this object? How can you only rely upon that power? Is something that I love seeing and love watching. I think it's really pulling it to the extreme, and therefore, yeah, sometimes it's nice to also fantasize about what you can do if you completely use that what is used against you, mm-hmm. and make it all your power.
Yeah. Yeah, some people already think that women use their sexuality to get power or to, I don't know, to be femme fatale. So if you turn it around and say, yes, yes, indeed, I'm using my sexuality, here it is, then you can own that accusation.
Yeah. But then also, as with the femme fatale, I don't think it ever ends in a good way with her, with the super whore either. Like, it's also still death and destruction.
Yeah.
Or do we have a positive hooker ending?
Probably, but... We have to think about that.
Yeah, I don't know her.
A positive hooker ending.
Yeah.
Never in my life I thought I would say on a podcast, do we have a positive hooker ending?
No.
Poor Things? Does that kind of apply in...
No, because her prime thing is not the hooker thing. Or maybe it is.
She's constantly... Can I swear on this podcast? She's constantly fucking...
Yeah, but when she starts working at the brothel, at first she's like, okay, now I can earn some money doing my hobby. But then she finds out that she doesn't get to choose the man, and she objects. And they say, well, you can't choose. You have to sleep with the man that want to sleep with you. And she's like, okay. So that was a really sad moment for
me.
Yeah,
yeah.
And she still enjoys it, but sometimes the guys smell or something and she has to endure it. So I didn't really like that.
No.
Could we maybe take it back a little bit before we dive into some more films and maybe explain a bit why gender is performative and what we mean by that, and why women are often so good at performing their gender?
I have a quote ready because... Bring it. Gloria Steinem, the feminist theorist, wrote a book on Marilyn Monroe, which is really, really interesting. But she hated Marilyn Monroe when she was a teenager and she saw Marilyn Monroe on screen. She was still alive. And she said that she felt discomfort at seeing her. And I really like this description, mincing and whispering and hoping her way into love and approval. So she felt like Monroe was holding a mirror to the exaggerated ways in which female human beings are trained to act, end quote. And she said it was sad and revealing. But later on, she changed her mind and she thought, well, it's actually kind of interesting that she's holding up this mirror. And I think it is. And I also feel this discomfort. Like in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, where Marilyn Monroe plays Lorelai Lee, this dumb blonde gold digger type. And it's so over the top, and it's kind of painful and pleasurable to watch because you think like, yeah, maybe I have been taught to act like this, to be naive and to be sweet. And I don't know, it's just, it wouldn't be real to watch strong women on screen all the time because that's not reality. Reality is different than that. So... that's what makes it interesting. This is not an answer to your question at all, is it? But I think the thing is that women and girls, when they're younger, are taught to perform in a kind of way, to be social, to make everything easy, to never be difficult in a way. So to see someone do such a performance, you think like, yes, I understand this. And even if it's a performance that is not about pleasing, but it's about being all the things that you are taught not to be, then it's still interesting and recognizable. It's still holding up a mirror. So I think there's something in that.
A quote I actually got of Lorelai in the film, I think maybe might help us here.
Say, they told me you were stupid. You don't sound stupid to me.
I can be smart when it's important, but most men don't like it.
Yes. Aww. Yeah.
Does someone want to explain the plot and then maybe we can dive into the film? Because I think that could help us.
Yeah. It started out as a book from the 20s, which is an important thing because it's really a 20s plot. But it's about two girlfriends and one of them is really romantic and falls in love all the time, wants to fall in love. But she's also grounded in a way. And the other one is Lorelai Lee, played by Marilyn Monroe, and she's the gold digger. She goes after the money. And I think that's all you need to know about the movie.
Yes, it was a great book. Greater as a Broadway stage hit, and even more gorgeous, glittering, and hilarious on the screen. With Marilyn Monroe as Lorelai Lee, the world's most fabulous gold-digging blonde.
I just love finding new places to wear diamonds.
And Jane Russell as Dorothy Shaw, the world's most talked about brunette.
But the interesting thing is that I have been watching this movie since I was a little girl, and I've been singing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, and I always thought, okay, this is a girl that really likes sparkling things, likes to have money. And then I found out that to be a gold digger is actually about something else. It's about independence. Because if you're a girl and you're not married, especially in the 20s, but up until the 60s, you were not allowed to open a bank account if you were a woman. So to get the jewelry was to have a sort of savings account, something to show for in the end when you have been broken up with or your husband wants to divorce you. So it's actually when she sings Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
Men grow cold as girls. Charms in the end, but square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
She is singing about independence, and
wow.
Yeah, so I think that is what the movie is about.
Whoa, that's so not my takeaway, but it makes so much sense.
Yeah, and of course, it's about friendship. Which I also really like about this movie.
I actually, before I saw Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, I saw, have you guys ever seen the remix video of the film that Laura Mulvey made of one of the songs in the film where, I don't know, they do a song on the stairs?
It's the opening sequence, I think, the opening scene.
Could be. I don't remember. But they sing a song. And then there is, while they're singing, the dress strap of Marilyn sort of falls off her shoulder. And it's really an accident. But she then very smoothly pulls it back on her shoulder again. And she does it while she's singing the song. And you don't really see it when you see the scene. But Mulvey made a remix of it where you watch this strap falling off the shoulder over and over again. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, she stretches it out. She makes it in slow motion. And then you watch it from up close and from afar again. And then you're looking at this thing for, I think, 5 minutes, this shoulder strap movement. Well, when you see that, you sort of understand this whole magic of Marilyn, where basically within her whole body, whatever she does, it is so Marilyn and so seductive in every part of her finger that you see the absurdity of her doing the sexiest thing ever by accident.
Mm.
That because that was the first thing I knew of this film.
Mm.
It is how I watched the whole film. So then you only see a woman who's trapped within her own skin from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, but she is. Yeah.
It's funny that you're describing where her sexuality has become such a small, specific detail, which is an accident. So it's her sexuality coming through the film. While you were describing the film, I was constantly thinking, and I think this has to do a lot with also the femme fatale stereotype, is that where is the femininity and where is the performance and where is the desire or the shaping by a male director, or how patriarchy has sort of pushed Marilyn Monroe to an extent to perform her femininity in such a way that she's become this object of desire for men. Mm-hmm. When you describe this strap, it's her, and it's for herself, probably not for the here is Marilyn Monroe for the pleasure of gentlemen. You know, so I find that's a very interesting fine line, right? I think
that's what makes it interesting, that sure, it's a fine line.
Of course, yeah.
And I think the fact that it's a male director is part of it. I mean, you also have a lot of interesting female characters directed by women, of course, especially. But I think even then, the male gaze is part of it. And that's what makes it a mirror to women.
Which then reflects back.
Yeah.
It's like this bouncing effect,
yeah,
right?
It's bouncing.
The gaze goes that way, and then the performance changes due to the gaze, and then it goes back, and then it's like this weird endless loop of I would imagine as a female, this is such a weird sentence, becomes, there are expectations of you that are bizarre in a way, right? This what are you doing here? What are you performing?
Mm-hmm.
Are you performing for somebody else? Is this for yourself?
Yeah.
As you said, has society pushed you to do certain things and you're like, wait, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Is this me or is this...
Yeah, but it's such a part of...
Sorry, I sound like a guy who suddenly finds out that...
Women have a really hard
but
life.
But I'm trying to, you know, be this, the voice of... dumb,
the spectator.
Dumb man.
Yes. No, but I like, yes. But also there's a lot of enjoyment in it because it's also an attainable fantasy. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like can do with your shoulder what Marilyn does with her shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is a stereotype and it is a fantasy, but it works its magic, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's
there's something to be reckoned, but also played with. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that I think is also the freedom part, because then you realize, oh, it's all moldable,
right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting. It's you saw this movie and you saw how she's trapped. And I saw the movie and I see her singing about independence. But her independence is... dependent on whether she gets the diamonds or not, and whether she's sexy enough to obtain those. And the whole movie plot is about her going after a diamond tiara.
How do you put it around your neck?
You don't, Lovey. It goes on your head.
You must think I was born yesterday.
Well, sometimes there's just no other possible explanation.
No, my dear. She's quite right. Like so. It's a tiara.
You do wear it on your head. I just love finding new places to wear diamonds.
That she has to manipulate her way to get it and kind of steal it. So it's, I mean, she's singing this song with all her heart, but she still has to get those diamonds, and otherwise she's nowhere. So if she didn't have her looks, she wouldn't have the diamonds. She wouldn't have her freedom. She would be dependent on some... a father figure or some guy without any money.
I was really touched by, in your book, you talk about Carmen Jones.
Mm-hmm.
The sensational long-run Broadway musical hit by Oscar Hammerstein, who gave you Showboat, Oklahoma, South Pacific, and The King and I. Brought to the screen by Otto Preminger, who produced and directed such hits as Laura and The Moon is Blue. With a cast of show world favorites starring Harry Belafonte, Dorothy Dandridge, Pearl Bailey.
What's mine's yours, Joey. And that goes right down the line.
You take us to Chicago. Show us a good time. What we got to do for you?
Don't ask him that now, honey. Let's get to Chicago first.
See you run out on me. Sure. We can give you a better time than I can. Fancy clothes. Swell company. The whole works. Husky Miller's latest woman. Only that ain't the way it's gonna be. I swore let no man take you away from me.
How are you gonna stop me?
I'll show you.
I think very related to this story, or at least it's a film that I didn't know, and also an actress that I didn't know, but I would say she has a very parallel life to what yeah. Marilyn lived. Maybe you want to talk about it a little?
Yeah, I think it was released in the same year as Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, so 1953 or 4. It's Dorothy Dandridge who plays the main part. It's directed by Otto Preminger.
Who also made Laura. So there's yes. a weird
film noir. Wow.
The big film noir.
Yeah.
With the big film fatale. With Gene Tierney again.
Yeah.
We're going in circles.
And Otto Preminger did make a lot of film noir. And then he decided to do Carmen Jones, which is, it has some similarities with the film noir, but it's a take on Carmen, the famous opera by Bizet. But it has an all African-American cast and it's a musical. So it's about this girl called Carmen Jones, and she is just a complete femme fatale, and she's really alluring but also fickle, and you can't depend on her, and she's just like, oh, this is a nice looking gentleman, oh, I like this one better, and you don't know yeah, you don't know what she's going to do. But in the end, she pays for it as well. So she's really a femme fatale type of character. Yeah, the story of Dorothy Dandridge is she made this movie. This was her big, big movie. And then she got nominated for an Oscar for it as the first black woman to have been nominated for Best Actress. And she was on the cover of Life as the first black woman ever and all that sort of stuff. But it didn't really work out that well. She had an affair with Otto Preminger, which was really tumultuous. He was married. And in the end, she died pretty young, and the same way as Marilyn Monroe. So in bed because of an overdose, I'm not sure. She was also ill, but it's just like shrouded in mystery, just as Marilyn Monroe's death. And they knew each other. They were kind of friends. I don't know how well they knew each other, but
the inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she had a bad marriage with a man who stole all her money and daughter who was disabled. So it's just a really sad life story. But she's fantastic.
And that film is yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder, because we've already mentioned two actors here, how they're using film to resist in some way, in the sense that in their own lives they can't perhaps escape the grasp of patriarchy, and in the end they are almost punished for acting out in some way, but yet within film they're able to somehow subvert what is expected of them, or to use that thing that's held against them as their power that makes them the stars that they are.
I'm being going cross-eyed by what you're saying, but
well, the sense there's such a duality there. The performances that they play in a way mirror their own lives.
Yeah.
But it's within cinema and film that they're able to fight back, but in their own lives they can't, let's say.
Yeah, I think in the case of Marilyn Monroe, it was really an exaggeration of the feeling of not being loved and at the same time always being looked at, because she was really young when she was fully developed. So everyone on the street was like turning their heads, like, who is this woman? And she was 14 years old. So this was really, yeah, kind of traumatic, but also exciting. She didn't have parents, so she was really alone in the world, but she was being looked at. So being in movies was like an exaggeration of that. So, okay, keep looking at me so I feel loved. But of course, in the end, that's not the same thing. That's
because how would they? I don't really see how she fights back.
Well, in the sense that, like, well, for instance, with Lorelai, the fact that she changes how we view that character might be they're actually more intelligent and aware, and they're using their power or position as being considered the dumb blonde or the gold digger
to then liberate
themselves or to then demand compensation for the beauty that's sort of been exacted on them.
I do see that Marilyn Monroe really fills the stereotypes that she plays with warmth.
Mm.
She's really a human being. Also in Some Like It Hot, for example. Mm. She's such a warm person, and you really like looking at her, not only because she's beautiful, but also because she's just warm-blooded, you know, and so charming and breezy. And so that's something that she established in those movies. I don't think
she's not dumb. She's naive.
She's naive.
Right? And naive doesn't mean that somebody is necessarily not smart. I think that's the takeaway I always have with Marilyn Monroe, is that, well, yeah, what you say, it's like the warmth is... That's why denigrating her to a dumb blonde is like... She's clearly never really a dumb blonde in these films. Maybe that's more the echo of her identity in culture is more like, oh, yeah, like... hot chick, dumb blonde. Like, yeah, no, you haven't watched any of her films, clearly.
Mm-hmm. But I think we can own the stereotype of the dumb blonde. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's okay for her to be dumb blonde. I think it's okay for her to be dumb blonde. Because she's also lots of other things.
Yeah.
But in real life, she wasn't dumb.
Okay, but maybe we should move away from this. We're going into tragedy,
yes.
And that was not our plan. We were going for
I really, really would like to talk about Showgirls for a bit more, because it's also the most male gazey film ever.
So what are you going to Vegas for? You gonna win?
I'm gonna dance.
There's a spot open in the chorus line. We're auditioning tomorrow morning. I think you should try out.
I got an audition!
Okay, ladies, I got one interest here, and that's the show. I don't care whether you live or die. I want to see you dance, and I want to see you smile. I can't use you if you can't smile. I can't use you if you can't show. I can't use you if you can't sell.
You need to explain.
I need to explain Showgirls.
Yes.
Yes.
And also its reception initially.
All of it.
That
it
goes hand
poor.
In hand. Yeah. It's 1992.
It's 1995.
Oh, sorry. It's not even 1992. It's 1995.
Basic Instinct is 1992.
That, exactly. That's what I was thinking about. Basic Instinct. Yeah, so that's a femme fatale. Well, actually, it's 1992. This works. together with Joe Esterhaas, who wrote the screenplay for Basic Instinct, Paul Verhoeven makes... Or shall I say Paul Verhoeven, because I say it in that video and everybody gave me flack for it. Okay, so I had to say
Paul
that on the podcast. Paul Verhoeven directed Basic Instinct, and based on a... I think the script for Basic Instinct by Joe Esterhaas, look him up, because if you see Joe Esterhaas's face, it's like, well, yeah, you're going to make Showgirls in a couple of years. He looks like this very dirty old man. But Basic Instinct was a huge success. So those two guys thought, you know what? We can do anything. Let's make a movie but that's, well, A Star is Born, but then in Las Vegas, about a woman who wants to join a... Well, yeah, what is it? It's like a Las Vegas... How do you call that? Like, not variety, but...
Yeah, something like that. Cabaret.
It's a dancing show.
Entertainment.
Dancing.
Just...
Yeah. Entertainment, like air quotes, because the entertainment is that they're going to be nude or
topless.
Topless, yeah. And it's starring Elizabeth Berkley as Naomi Malone, a woman who at the beginning of the film we only know as a hitchhiker who goes to... It's the most campy 90s film I've seen. When it was released, it was a complete box office failure. Everybody hated it, and it won many Razzie Awards. And I think Verhoeven was one of the first directors ever.
He was the first director.
Who received it,
and the speech is
lovely.
What's
a Razzie Award?
A Razzie Award is the flip side of the coin of an Academy Award. So it's the Razzies are awards for the worst film ever, the worst performance.
Yeah, of the year.
Of the year, yeah.
And they're pretty sexist, so it's always just like films with ladies in them. Yuck, we hate them. Here's a Razzie. But I mean, it was nice that Verhoeven came by to pick it up and give a speech.
Thank you very much. The worst thing happened to me today. I got 7 of the worst awards. And I'm very happy because it was much better, much more fun than reading the reviews in September. Thank you so much.
So that's nice. Yeah, also the thing with Showgirls is that beforehand, everyone was like, it's going to be porno on screen and it's X-rated and let's watch porno together in the theaters. And then it came out and everyone was like, it's not sexy at all. So, but I don't think it's meant to be that sexy. It's about sex, but it's also about the American dream and capitalism and in how fake Las Vegas is and the United States.
Like so, all Verhoeven's films,
yes,
really.
Yeah. So it's not about sex. Sex is a tool in the movie. So you shouldn't get aroused. You have to look at it from quite a distance. And nobody really understood that. But we understand it now. So people really enjoy it for the campy movie that it is. Full of overacting. And so Elizabeth Berkley also got lots of... a critique on...
It more or less destroyed her career, right?
It destroyed her career. It was building up to this, and then it was just out of her hands. But...
Because she was in... What was the series called again?
Saved by the Bell.
Saved by the Bell. Mm.
Where
she was
the nerd.
Yeah, the most girl next door ever she was, I think, in that series.
Yeah?
Well, maybe just like a... Well, here we
she
go,
wasn't
here
the,
we go
the
with
hot
stereotypes
girl.
Again.
Yeah, but it's really, it's full of stereotypes. I think she was the, like, I don't remember. It's I did watch
but
it.
Was, it. Well, at least it was miles away of what she performs in.
But she's so good. What do you
she's
think?
She's so good. I love her. Yeah. I think what is so great about her, but also the film in general, is that indeed you know that you're gonna watch something sexy or like that the titties are coming, but then you know the whole thing that that is, I would say, Nomi's main focus is that she's afraid of being the hooker. So, but of course, a lot of what she does comes very close to being a sex worker. Everything in her body is sort of doing the sexy thing, but with so much anger that it becomes so weird to look at. And I think like one of my favorite thing in this film is the choreography of the performances. Mm. It's like they're like constantly just elbowing but with the titties out. And it's so weird and it's so angry and it's so aggressive. But, you know, they're bouncing as hard as they can. Mm. So that's, I don't know, I love this sort of sexy anger that is so unique to this film. It's not something that I see, that I've ever seen before. And it's, what Verhoeven was supposed to do. It's like Las Vegas, the most American dream that exists, but with this super bold Dutch attitude of, you know, putting things on the table. That's the America that I want to see more often.
And then in the end, it moves into such incredibly dark territory.
It's so intense.
It's the rape scene and everything that then follows after that, the revenge, etc., is so intense.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the sex scene in the swimming pool, one of the most
pretty
bizarre.
Intense.
Yeah, it's really and
that's
not arousing.
No. Anger sexing.
Sad. More?
It took a long, I think. It took more than 10 years to actually think that of people saying like, "Wait, isn't this literally meant as a very weird, campy satire?" Because it is indeed not sexy at all. It's like almost objectively not sexy.
I don't think it's that campy because the anger is so real and it's also really, I think it's so successfully Me Too avant la lettre in a way that it's revealing a truth which at the time wasn't really something that you could or would talk about.
Yeah, like it's there, but it's not like the guy who in the when they are exactly, being raided yeah. or like it's the like what is it theater owner or the production guy or, like yeah. I don't like your tits like yeah. that's, I think he literally says something like along the lines of that show me your tits they're yeah. too small get out like what what
yeah yeah this yeah is, but it also moves, the,
it makes it even makes that so big that it's like wait what is it a, is this it is critiquing
yeah
but in a maybe not campy way but.
No, I think it's really earnest, actually. And that's why it can be interpreted as campy. Mm-hmm. And it works as camp. But it's really earnest. And that's what's so great about it. That Verhoeven really feels this way about America and the American dream. And about sex being used as to gain things instead of just being enjoyed. He really likes... he really likes sex. He talks about it a lot. And he likes the fact that sex can be fun and you know, intimate. So he really opposes the type of sex that we see in this movie. In the swimming pool, he hates this type of sex. And you can feel it and it makes you uncomfortable. Like, oh, maybe sex isn't that nice? I don't know. I feel it's the opposite of sexy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so nice that because... in this world of showgirls, you cannot have a normal sexual encounter with a man because everything is a transaction. Every actual sexual encounter has then to be between women. Yeah. Like the only alternative is being a lesbian.
Yeah, the sexy stuff is in the relationship between Nomi and
Gina Gershon.
I can't even remember her name, let alone the character's name. I don't know. But those are the sexy scenes. But they're also about conniving and yeah. Competing. And
the entire sort of weird sisterhood scene of the beginning of their almost sexual relationship.
Yeah.
Which is a conversation about eating doggy food.
It's so strange.
I used to eat doggy chow too. Like
I've had dog food.
You have?
Mm-hmm. Long time ago. Doggy chow. I used to love doggy chow.
I used to love doggy chow too.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's
this is a conversation? Weird. And then because after they discuss that and then do that weird thing with a biscuit, like they do this.
The cheers.
The cheers with the biscuit. It then, because I was making toasting. The trailer, it immediately cuts to her pouring champagne into a glass and it's like, yes. We are women enjoying ourselves. You were just discussing eating dog food. Like, what is this?
It's so strange. Yes, I really like that.
Yeah, it's so good.
Nice dress.
Thanks. I bought it at Versace.
I love Versace.
Me too.
Nice dress.
Thanks. It's a Versace.
It's Versace.
What?
I found a Letterboxd review that feels like it could be written by Kiliko. And it says, the people who think Showgirls is dumb are the same people who think Inception is clever.
That's me. That's yeah. me. Classic. Yes. Follow me at... Oh my God. It's so true though.
Should we discuss Sunset Boulevard? That's yes. one film we have to talk about.
Yeah.
What you're trying to say is you don't want me to love you. Say it. Say it.
Gloria Swanson, one of the great personalities of this generation in a role that comes to an actress once in a lifetime. Rising to the heights, William Holden creates a startling portrayal. And a new star is born in Sunset Boulevard, Miss Nancy Olson.
Joe? Where are you? What's this all about?
Why don't you come out and see for yourself? The address is 10,086 Sunset Boulevard.
Yes, come out to see for yourself the film that reaches a new milestone of dramatic daring. The film that every critic says is a giant among motion pictures.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. It's been a long time since I last saw it. But I thought, yeah, it's really grotesque. The character is grotesque, but the movie making is also grotesque. So I think the character of Norma Desmond, I'm diving into it too fast, am
yeah.
I? Yeah.
What is Sunset Boulevard?
What is
Where
the story?
Is Sunset Boulevard?
Well, it's in Hollywood. It's another take on the American dream. Yeah, Gloria Swanson is this, the actress, plays like a grotesque version of herself, Norma Desmond. Gloria Swanson, she's a silent movie star, so she was one of the greats, and everybody forgot about her. And then she did Sunset Boulevard, about a Hollywood great from the silent era, who everyone forgot about. But she's this really, yeah, she's this diva who doesn't want to know the reality. So she's in her villa, her mansion, and surrounded by just images of herself as a young woman in this illusion. And she starts an affair with a young man, and well, then stuff happens.
To not spoil the film and at the same time spoil the film because the film spoils itself, yeah, is that it starts off with an amazing shot of a swimming pool, of a dead guy laying in the swimming pool in the water, and then his voiceover starts.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, Billy Wilder, applause for you.
Yeah.
Nice.
Wasn't it one of the first films to do that? Yeah. Reveal the ending, yeah, at the start.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a shot from inside the pool. So you, yeah, you see the body from...
Yeah, from below.
From below. And then you see the photographers, like the, yeah, paparazzi,
yeah,
photographing the, yeah, the dead body.
And that shot was impossible. Because,
yeah,
you
of
couldn't,
course.
You can't put, so they shot against a... through a mirror that is actually underwater. So it's like this weird, for a film noir, like from the 40s, a super 50s. Whoa, 50, yeah. Ooh, Jesus. 1992. it's a very elaborate and insanely weird shot, but yeah.
Yeah.
But then it does the classic film noir thing, of course. Like, that's this. Here's the story of a guy, what happened to him.
Yeah.
Well...
Yeah,
it's
I'm
a woman
tell
again,
you.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she did it. Yeah, so she's really this grotesque character, and it's a really grotesque movie. It's really, it's sort of a satire, not a complete satire, but it's in there. Yeah, I don't know. It's about how she is just in this illusion, but also how we forget about people when they grow old, and what is the famous quote?
I'm ready for my close up, Mr.
Yeah,
DeMille.
Also, but also,
you're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
So that really was a thing, huh? Like, for those silent movie actors,
yeah,
they were like. It's just so many films about this, them,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
losing their fame.
And it's a bizarrely meta film because,
yeah,
the butler is also played by, and I always mess these two up, but it's von Stroheim, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it's Erich von Stroheim, who himself was a very well-known silent movie director.
Yeah.
Also worked with Dietrich, right? I think so. Yeah, think so, yeah.
But he also directed Gloria Swanson in a silent film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is then played in the Sunset Boulevard.
Wow.
Because now in this movie he's the butler, but he used to be a director as,
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
And also Buster Keaton is in the movie. In,
oh, yeah, of
a cameo.
Course, yeah.
And he,
yeah,
is famously, he was an independent filmmaker and he was on top of the game, of his game. And then he lost everything.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's actually a documentary, Sunset Boulevard.
It is, yes.
But I think that's the beauty of Gloria Swanson, in the sense that she creates such this blurred distinction between herself and the character that,
mm-hmm,
then after the film, the audience kind of just assumed that she is that,
yeah,
person.
Yeah.
Whereas she kind of was just went on to live her life in a very fun, fun way. She ended up doing like having a cooking show and stuff like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And she didn't really care that her time in Hollywood had finished or anything, but everybody just assumed that she'd become this old, miserable, washed-up star.
Yeah, it's such a fearless thing to do.
Yeah.
To do this part. Yeah, it's great. It's just fantastic. It's so over the top. And the ending with the, I'm ready for my close-up now, when she's being,
yeah,
arrested. Sorry for the spoiler.
I just want to tell you all how happy I am to be back in the studio, making a picture again. You don't know how much I've missed all of you. And I promise you I'll never desert you again. Because after Salome, we'll make another picture and another picture. You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else. Just us. And the cameras. And those wonderful people out there in the dark. All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Well, then maybe Norma Desmond meets Naomi Malone brings us to Grace Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she's like the love child of these two ladies.
In the 90s, yes.
Yeah.
Please explain.
Well, one of the other films that Basha suggested we watched for this conversation is a film called Boomerang.
Like, haven't you ever seen a guy and thought he was attractive?
Women do stuff like that. You see other girls and you say, oh, she's cute, or her hair is nice, but guys don't see other guys and go, oh, look at his shoulders. We don't do that. I'll give you that vibe. Now, you know what your problem is? You need more romance and less dopamine pincher. That's what you need.
Oh, God.
I am Mr. Romance when I meet a woman, and then once I hit it, I lose interest, but that ain't my fault.
And...
Is no, it 1992?
It's 1992.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's actually possible.
Yeah. Yes.
They made films that year.
There's one character in this film which is, which goes, you know.
Stranger, right?
Above and beyond Stranger. All expectations. Stranger, played by Grace Jones, who is, I would say, has the same form of being disillusioned as Norma, but also has this intense anger sex thing that yeah. she's constantly putting into the world, where she mentions her vagina in every possible way all the time.
Because I think it's spectacular.
Yeah, it's so
it
good.
It must be spectacular.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so good. That pussy is wow. Wow. And actually also I had never watched the film, but here in this case also I saw a clip of the film many times before seeing the film.
Yes.
Because there is one monologue about her pussy.
Oh, merde alors. I mean, I don't believe this. You are going to turn down a pussy like this? Staring you smack in your face? No man can turn down this pussy.
Will you stop?
I don't know any man that can refuse this pussy.
Stop throwing pussy. People are eating in here.
Pussy. Pussy, pussy, pussy. Pussy. Puss, puss, pussy.
Trying to find our cat. Where is that cat?
That she has in the film, where she just constantly repeats pussy, which is the introduction to the music video Pussy by Iggy Azalea.
Ah.
Mm.
And I never knew where that was from. And now that I know, now I know
now
it's
you know.
Stranger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it keeps popping up, that clip of her saying pussy. Yeah,
it's so good. Yeah.
It's very good. Yeah. And it's actually this time it's a woman that is abusing her power to get sex, which is not good. I don't endorse it, but it's interesting to see. And it's nice to see her make a man really uncomfortable. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, 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 it is. Yeah.
Now the tables have turned.
Yeah.
I'm also reading that a lot of Grace Jones's performance was improvised as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
But Grace Jones herself yeah. is a performance.
We haven't really said who she is.
Yeah, but the thing
she's
is,
also just a person.
In this movie where she plays Stranger, she's really, really this stereotype of the cougar and someone who has a lot of power and abuses that power. But before that, I mean, in the 70s, she was already making music and doing stuff and being this New York party girl. But I really like her in the 80s when she was just like... feminine and masculine at the same time, and she was this whole new sort of sexy that you were like, wait, this woman is really attractive and really beautiful, but she's also, she's not
round like we're used to, like Marilyn Monroe, who's round, but she's more angular and with short hair and just really this interesting woman to look at. And also really hard in a way, but not in a way that you find that she keeps you at a distance. No. She pulls you in, even if she's hard. So I really like that period. And it's different from what she does as Stranger in Boomerang. But yeah, I really adore Grace Jones.
It's funny that you mentioned the shape, because it's like the thing that Disney did, right? They had the Kiki shape and the other shape.
What?
I can't remember.
Blob.
The blob. Yeah, so Disney had at the animation studio, they had a rule that if you wanted to depict a kind character, the character should mostly be round. And they had a name for it. I can't remember what the round one was. And and so every villainous character, like if you look at, for instance, at Jafar's face, it's pointy. So there's always like a triangle in somewhere in the face, and that's the Kiki shape.
It's also Cruella de Vil.
Exactly.
But not Ursula in The Little Mermaid.
Right.
She's round.
She's round. Yeah. Yeah.
But she's just like a fat phobic type of character.
I guess so. She became too round. Maybe that's what they did there. Yeah, I don't know.
Abundance is also bad. Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Was Grace Jones was in Live and Let Die, right? That's or was it? I can't remember which. It's a Dalton one.
Not License to Kill. Live and Let Die. It's the Paris one.
It's the Paris one. Yes, man looking stuff up on a computer.
I can, never,
can you tell us
A View to Kill?
A View to a Kill.
A View to a Kill. Of course. Yes.
She's the henchwoman. Of Christopher Walken, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, who's blonde in this movie.
Yeah.
And she sleeps with James Bond, and it's really awkward. When they wake up together, you're like, these people don't match at all. But maybe that's the point.
Yeah, because there's also something... What's fascinating for me in Grace Jones is that she's also very much to be feared, which makes her at the same time very sexy, but also kind of asexual in that setting with James Bond.
Yeah.
She's not really there to... She's maybe even too emancipated in the confines of the Bond structure to then have sex with him.
Yeah.
It's like, huh? No.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
The limits of womanhood. That's where it ends. Oh. The confinements. Oh.
We've kind of like nicely touched on some key moments in film history, and I think that's a reflection of Girls Aplenty program, but maybe we can just have a look at films today and whether we still think the same things are happening. And
yeah, and also how the, I would say, how are female stereotypes, what? Female, 1992. How are female stereotypes doing now with a far bigger influx of female filmmakers, because a lot of these films that we've discussed are made by men. How have things changed? How female filmmakers handling these stereotypes?
Yeah, I immediately think of Love Lies Bleeding, which is an interesting movie about amour fou between two young women, and one of them is really being gazed at all the time. She's a bodybuilder, so she's really all about the way she looks, but it's in a different way than what we're used to, what we think or have been taught is sexy. So she's really strong, and the camera is really searching her body, or how do you call it? Looking at the body, gazing at the body, but we see muscles instead of like the roundness that we talked about. So this is kind of averting a stereotype and introducing a new type of stereotype. So I think that's interesting, and it's by a female director,
Rose Glass, right?
Rose Glass,
with Kristen Stewart, Stewart, and I can't remember who plays the bodybuilder girl.
No, me neither. Are there any?
I really like that film. I thought it was a very 90s thriller kind of thing with. Which you don't really see anymore nowadays.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, and it's also film noir-ish in a way, neo-noir. Yeah.
Here you go. What is your interpretation of the future of female stereotypes? and how are female directors changing things
or not at all.
Yeah, exactly. Or just taking
maybe
those stereotypes.
Maybe we need that male gaze to have a...
Maybe we do. Yeah. Maybe we do. Well, maybe the most obvious answer to this is Sofia Coppola, who we've discussed previously, last time when you came on this podcast, because then we spoke about The Beguiled, if I'm remembering this correctly, who basically makes film about what it's like for a woman to live in those confinements that we have been describing, of women who are also one with how they're perceived and who they are and how that becomes one and the complexity of that.
Yeah, she's really good. She's a really great example. And also, if you look at The Virgin Suicides, it's all about, we look through the eyes of the neighborhood boys at these women, and still it works. We still understand what these girls feel, even though they're being looked at, or just because they're being looked at. So that's so interesting. And yeah. I don't think a male director could have nailed that as well as she did.
No, it's actually such a successful combination of what you described in the beginning, in your cold open. It's both celebrating the stereotype whilst also showing the layers and the complexity of not a woman, but of a human being.
Yeah, yeah. Good one.
What other films are there in the program? I'm curious.
That is a very good question.
We have Marlene Dietrich in The Scarlet Empress. She's nice. Divine, and the movie is so great to watch on a big screen. We have Divine in Female Trouble. The Substance, a new movie. It's coming out soon, and it's going to be added to Girls of Plenty. We have...
La Notte.
La Notte.
By Michelangelo Antonioni.
Oh, that's very sexy. and we have Cries and Whispers by Ingmar Bergman.
We have Safe.
We have Safe.
Oh, shit. Wow. A movie I so incredibly love.
Is it from 1992? No, it's not.
Oh, it's again from 1995. Yeah. Damn it.
We have To Die For, which is with Nicole Kidman. And then, let's see, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Carmen Jones also.
Antichrist.
Antichrist, Lars von Trier.
That
is
a funky choice. I love that.
Yeah.
And we have Showgirls.
And we have Showgirls.
And Mommy Dearest.
Mommy Dearest, which is just like... Which is batshit insane. It's such a crazy movie, but I love it. And it's about Joan Crawford, but we also have Joan Crawford in Johnny Guitar, which is also fantastic.
Nice.
You really should see it. And then that's it.
Nice. Until when does it run?
I think most of the films will still be playing, but maybe not with nightly shows. I think at the end of October. So
okay. Nice.
There's super. a lot of times to still
catch up. We'll see you in the cinema.
Yeah.
If you want to stay up to date with everything we're doing here on Celebrating Cinema and at Lab, you can follow us at @lab111 on both Instagram and now also Letterboxd. Listen back to our episode on the myth of Orson Welles and our latest interview with Dutch filmmaker Laura Hermanides about her latest film, Witte Flits. We also want to hear from you. Send in your favorite cinema memories as a voice note to celebratingcinema@lab111.nl and we will include them in our next episode. If you like what we do here, you can support us by sharing it with your friends or by leaving a review on whichever podcast platform. It really does help us. You can find all films mentioned, bonus info, and link to tickets in the show notes. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, music from Hugo Emmerzaal, and artwork from Studio FFF.